All rise.
Welcome to the Cyber Law and Business Report. Get the top story on the hot button internet legal topics of the day. This is your home for the latest on internet law and policy. Hear the latest net trends impacting business and have your questions answered right here. This is the Cyber Law and Business Report. Now, please welcome your host, the founder of the Internet Law Center, Bennett Kelly.
Good morning. This is Bennett Kelly broadcasting live from the Internet Law Center here in Santa Monica, the heart of Silicon Beach. Please be seated. We've got a great show for you today. We have a repeater, our distinguished University of Miami law professor and Civil Rights Initiative vice president, Mary Ann Franks, is joining us from Miami, I believe, and where it's hopefully everyone's recovered from the hurricane. And but we are going to be talking about the state of cyber exploitation and as well as maybe some issues of funding. But Mary Ann, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Thank you for joining us. You know, when you last spoke, I was looking at the show notes, and only a handful of states had actually passed laws dealing with revenge porn at that point. And now we're up to 34. So it seems like there's been a lot of progress at the state level since we last spoke.
There has been. There's really been a flurry of legislative activity. And as you say, now we're up to 34 states, as well as Washington, D.C. And Congress is also getting finally sort of in on this issue and we've now introduced a federal bill as well.
So let me just back up. Tell me a little bit about the Cyber Civil Rights Initiative and your role. Because when we were talking about 34 states, how many of those states have you actually gone to and testified? Because I've seen you at several.
That's right. So there's been probably, in terms of actual direct testimony, probably half a dozen or so. In other states, what I've done is kind of a background legislative drafting role. So we start with the templates that the lawmakers have. They're sent to me and I'm asked to give my opinions about how it should be worded, what types of issues have arisen in other jurisdictions. And so probably for about 25 or 26 of the laws that have been passed, I've played some sort of role in the draft.
So, and the purpose of the Cyber Civil Rights Initiative is?
So the purpose of the Cyber Civil Rights Initiative is to challenge online abuse and discrimination. And our particular focus has been, since our inception in 2013, has been to focus on the issue of non-consensual pornography. But our broader agenda really is all forms of online abuse and discrimination.
And so there seems to be a looming battle or a developing attack line. And we saw that in Rhode Island. Mm-hmm. Where, you know, the ACLU actually led a fight against the bill, and the state's first female governor, who also went to my high school, and became the first governor to veto a revenge porn law. Why don't you tell us about that?
Right. That was an extremely disappointing event. What you had in Rhode Island was some very dedicated lawmakers, very smart people working on this bill and had been working. The attorney general had been trying to address this issue for years. And in this particular year, there was a very narrowly, carefully drafted law that had gone through several different iterations that was passed by the state legislature almost unanimously. It's a really, both in terms of its effectiveness and protectiveness, but also in terms of how sophisticated it is in terms of making sure that it comports with the First Amendment. And so everything seemed to be on track for this bill to be passed and for victims in Rhode Island to actually have some chance for justice. And sort of at the 11th hour, the ACLU and various other organizations basically launched an attack, direct appeal to the governor, asking her to veto this law. And on some very specious grounds, the bottom line or the impression they were trying to give was that there was some First Amendment problem with the bill. We looked at their criticisms quite carefully, and they're the same criticisms that the ACLU has made in the past. None of them really have any merit, and they're not really about the First Amendment, and yet for some reason, the governor found this compelling, and she did, in fact, veto the bill.
And what's interesting is that basically the ACLU was trying to say that the legislation needed to provide exceptions when dissemination of unauthorized images was in the public interest. And I think they were trying to make the argument that this law could somehow make photographs like Abu Ghraib, publishing those, or publishing the napalm girl in Vietnam, that somehow that would be rendered illegal. And what was interesting was that the Rhode Island legislation had greater protection than what is currently in place in California, and tracked the model legislation that you guys drafted. But nonetheless, that seemed to be what we have in place in California now for several years, but it was somehow deemed inadequate and led to a gubernatorial veto.
Right. And again, this is why this was so particularly surprising, was the fact that it is certainly right that whenever you're trying to craft a good law on an issue like this, there are so many things you need to consider, including the possibility for unintended consequences, for the statutes to be read too broadly, for them to be used in a discriminatory fashion. And much to the lawmakers' credit in Rhode Island, they had really thought about all of those issues. And as you say, had actually carved out quite a number of very thoughtful exceptions, including images that were disclosed and that had public concern. So what the ACLU really seems to be saying, in effect, is nothing is good enough, right? So even if there is an explicit exception in the law that says this doesn't apply to issues that are newsworthy or a public concern, the ACLU still says this is not okay because a newspaper or an outlet wouldn't know for sure in advance, because public concern and newsworthiness they can be controversial, not entirely clear concepts. But of course, that's how laws work, right? I mean, there's no way to tell in advance how a particular concept is going to play out. That's what courts are for. And the idea, the test for whether or not that defeats a statute's constitutionality is not, can we think of bad effects, or is there any possible chance that this could be used in a way that might inhibit certain organizations from talking about this? Well, there's always a chance, but mere speculation is never enough. And the fact that the ACLU seems utterly unconcerned with the legitimate sweep of the statute, which is, in fact, to prosecute or knowingly disseminating these types of photos, knowing that they will harm or hurt these victims, it seems as though the ACLU is only ever concerned about one side of the equation and turns that a bare speculation about possible bad consequences, and seems to think that that's the only thing that might matter.
And it's interesting, the Speaker of the House, Nick Mattiello, said, "I'm extremely disappointed the governor vetoed an important tool to protect victims of sexual exploitation. I'm surprised because it raised any concerns during the 4 months that it was under consideration by the House. We passed the bill 68-1, which would have given the victims of sexual exploitation some common sense protection against increasingly shocking violations of privacy on the internet." So one, there was the issue of why wasn't this raised when the bill was pending, or at least raised persuasively. But now, is there any likelihood you guys can have a workaround?
The really alarming things about what happened. If the ACLU intends to talk in good faith about issues it has with legislation, of course the right time to do it is not after the legislature has actually passed a bill and is going up to the governor for signature. If these were legitimate complaints, if these are legitimate critiques, they should have been introduced much in advance. One suspects that actually that doesn't seem to be what the ACLU is after, that they know that they can create a kind of public relations issue that isn't necessarily on substance, and that might have an effect on certain politicians who haven't really researched the issue and may just not have the adequate background to process what's at stake.
Do you think that they're trying to tar this movement as being anti-First Amendment?
I think so, and I have hesitated to say that in the past, because you never know, based on maybe isolated incidents, if you can say that about what an organization is doing. And the ACLU does so much tremendously good work on other issues, and I think that's important always to say. But it now seems quite clear, now that there have been several years of this work and there have been several states and several efforts, that the ACLU's position has been I think, very much in bad faith. I think that they know that they don't have solid constitutional arguments against these laws. What they have are policy objections, which are perfectly acceptable for one to have. But they've managed to, and they have deliberately attempted to confuse, like, about the differences between those two. And their policy objections have gotten, they put them behind the shield of the First Amendment, which makes people want to believe that somehow these statutes violate freedom of speech. And if one doesn't know First Amendment doctrine very well, if we're not an expert in constitutional law, that sounds bad, right? If you
right.
throw out an accusation of, oh, this is against free speech, it's obviously very, you know, easy to get people to believe that.
That puts you on the defensive.
Yes.
And if I actually recently communicated with Speaker Mattiello for two purposes. One, to tell him that he better be at our high school reunion on on Saturday. And two, that I hope he passes something very quickly when the legislature comes back. But, you know, the ACLU move was strategic because the bill is now going to Congress. And Jackie Speier introduced the bill earlier this year. And so now it's a different discussion. And are they still trying to make the point in Congress that this is not a First Amendment-friendly bill? And is that gaining traction?
Well, this is where it, in fact, does get interesting, because when the bill was introduced over the summer, so Representative Speier introduced it during this press conference, and there was support, as you know, from a wide group of scholars and advocates, including people who are, quite frankly, experts on the First Amendment. So we have Erwin Chemerinsky saying there's no First Amendment problem with this bill.
Right.
Other scholars who are really, really prominent scholars whose, you know, constitutional credentials really cannot be impeached in any way, who are saying, no, you know, you may or may not like this bill, but it's not a First Amendment problem that you can have with this bill.
Right. Even had Eugene Bullock, who, who actually has supported some levels of harassment. So, that was an achievement.
Right. And so I think that that's going to make it interesting. But the problem is, of course, that, you know, you can have experts who say this is our read of a particular issue. And that doesn't mean that the general public or some politicians will necessarily heed that. Right. We're not exactly living in a golden era for expert information. So the troubling thing is that the ACLU may nonetheless, in spite of all this pretty compelling evidence by a wide and experts, that this is not this bill does not create the First Amendment problems that it is saying that it creates. It will be interesting to see if they will nonetheless try to say that somehow the few people at the ACLU who are handling this issue somehow know more or better than any of this wide range of groups of people, including members of the tech industry, who are usually heavily skeptical about any legislation that might impact their responsibility or liability. We've got, you know, Facebook and Twitter saying they support this bill. Not only that they're not going to fight it or that they don't like it, but that they support it.
Right.
Along with all the constitutional law experts, I think it becomes increasingly, it's a very discredited position that the ACLU is taking, but that won't necessarily stop them from taking it.
But it's curious because, you know, looking at who's behind it. So you have, you mentioned Facebook, you have Twitter, you have Nationalization for Women, Feminist Majority, Girls Inc., Internet Law Center. National Democratic Institute, and obviously the CCRI, Information Technology Innovation Foundation. And then, you know, you have Jackie Speier, who was one of the pioneers in internet policy when she was in Sacramento. You have Catherine Clark as a sponsor, who has been a major fighter in her brief time so far in Congress on issues of cyber harassment. And I have to give a shout out to one of your Republican sponsors, John Katko, who years ago we actually shared a secretary, and he's a freshman congressman from a conservative district, and you know, taking a stand on an important issue. And so I applaud him for his bipartisanship. But it doesn't. Despite that, there's been no hearings. No one else has joined to sign up on legislation. I actually asked my congressman, you know, how come he hasn't endorsed and signed on as a sponsor, Ted Lieu, and, in a tweet, and I haven't heard back. So, what I mean, granted, it came out midway through a Congress during election year, so you know, you may not expect a whole lot to happen. But are you surprised that nothing has happened?
Well, I think that timing does have a big role here, in that I think that the plan is to put this back on the stage when things maybe have calmed down a little bit in terms of our current political climate. So I think that that probably does account for a lot of, at least I hope that that's mostly what we're thinking about. But I do think it's probably also a testament to the fact that the sort of the tarring process, right, that the ACLU has engaged in, the sense of apprehension that it's managed to cultivate on this issue about freedom of speech is probably part of this. I think that, again, it takes some dedication and some time to figure out what exactly is happening. And if you are not somebody who has the time or the ability to do that, then you can obviously be easily swayed by people who are suggesting that there's a problem.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll be talking more with Marianne Franks on this very important issue. You're listening to Cyberlaw. Only on cranberry.fm.
Stay tuned for more of the Cyber Law and Business Report after this brief recess for our sponsors.
Literature is taking over Miami streets. Between November 13th and the 20th, downtown Miami will transform into a full week celebration of the literary arts. More than 500 plus authors are coming to share their new work at the 2016 Miami Book Fair. The Porch is open every evening, complete with a full schedule of live music and performances, a farmer's market and cafe, food trucks, craft beer, and more. For more information on the 33rd Miami Book Fair, November 13th to the 20th, at Miami-Dade College's Wolfson Campus in downtown Miami, call 305-237-3258 or visit miamibookfair.com. Follow Miami Book Fair on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Miami Book Fair.
Is your website hacked? Is your website displaying error messages or loading slowly? Even if there are no signs of malicious activity, your site may still be compromised. Websites, like cars, require regular maintenance to perform at their best and not leave you stranded. At Fjord, our website maintenance experts can help you assess which one of our maintenance plans will best support your needs. Visit fjorddigital.com or call 612-877-3840 and get the support and protection your website and business deserve. That's fjorddigital.com.
Cranberry Radio, online anytime at cranberry.fm. The best gavel-to-gavel legal news and information on the net is right here. This is the Cyber Law and Business Report. Here is Bennett Kelly.
And we're back, and we're talking to University of Miami Law Professor Marianne Franks, and she's talking about her efforts to pass revenge porn or cyber exploitation legislation, both at the state and federal level. Before the break, we were talking about the introduction of the bill by Jackie Speier, H.R. 589, the Intimate Privacy Protection Act. Now, you were there at the press conference announcing the introduction of the bill. That must have been quite an experience.
It really was a remarkable experience. Representative Speier wanted to have not only experts but also victims to speak at the press conference to really talk about the severity of the conduct and then to demonstrate or help demonstrate the need for congressional action on this issue. So it was such an honor, right, to really be in this place with the people that I've worked with for several years, because the victims who have come forward and been brave enough to take their stories forward and to work on these issues for so long, it's a great sense of pride that I have that I've been able to work with some of them, and that they were able to see that there is this, at least there is this attempt on the part of Congress, that there are some members of Congress who are listening, and they were there that day, you know, Republicans, Democrats, both, really be able to stand up and say, this, we are hearing you. It was really a very poignant and I think very important moment, at least for me personally, to see democracy working that way.
And so one of the people you're referring to is your the president of the Cyber Civil Rights Initiative, Holly Jacobs. And I'm looking at a tweet by Jackie Spear that has a photo of Holly speaking to the press conference, mentioning that, you know, when her photos were first posted, that she played suicide.
Right. Right. So, and this is a common experience of many of the victims who face this, because it is, as you know, it isn't just the fact that it happens to them. It's also the response that they get, that when they go to the police or when they tell their family or when they talk to politicians about it, if the answer is, this is your own fault, it's not a crime, it's not a big deal, that sense of dismissal and trivialization and lack of acknowledgement of what has happened to them after they've been able to gather the resources and the bravery to come forward and talk about it, it's been devastating for victims. And this was such an important counterpoint to all of that.
Now, one thing I found important here in California is Attorney General Kamala Harris has really made that a priority. And she was out here, and she actually had a press conference with Daniel Citron, your colleague, and to talk about her office was making to educate law enforcement about this. And you know, I found it very useful. You know, she created a bulletin for law enforcement on this issue. And every time I talk to a client and I tell them to talk to the police, I tell them to print this bulletin. So that right away, here's a tool. This really is a crime. This is really something serious.
Right. Attorney General Harris has done so much terrific work on this issue, Daniel Citron and so many others. And right now, I think especially we're at this moment where we see that there are state legislators willing to pass statutes on this issue. Sometimes they're good, sometimes they're not so good. But in any event, law enforcement has to be well informed about the changes in the law, and they have to know how they can actually go about prosecuting, investigating these cases effectively. And so it's so important not to just say, pass a law and leave it behind, but to say, let's talk about how this is actually going to work in practice.
And that is very important. Do you find the other attorney generals have been as effective as she has in this?
Well, I think that the Attorney General Harris is really a model for the way that this should work and the way that the process could work if you really have dedication to this issue and deep understanding of it. I don't think she's alone by any means, but I do think she's one of the most high profile and most thoughtful people who has taken this issue really head on and is really trying to make sure that whatever laws get passed are good laws, first of all, but also make sure we're having a larger conversation about all the steps that are necessary to be able to challenge this type of behavior, from making sure that victims understand what their rights are to making sure that law enforcement understands how it is that they can go about investigating these types of abuse appropriately.
Now, right now, the Intimate Privacy Protection Act is strictly in the House. It could be quite possible, in fact, extremely likely, that come January, you'll have a new friend in the Senate in Kamala Harris. Where does the bill stand in the Senate now?
Well, it seems as though there are many people in the Senate who are interested in running a similar bill there. There have been some ups and downs in terms of trying to figure out where the House was going to go when that bill was going to really take shape. So I think that what we're looking at is, as you say, I think in the next few months, we're going to be able to see more clearly exactly who it is will want to be the sponsor and who else will sign on. But there seems to be a lot of.
And do you think there will be any action after the election, or this is strictly a next Congress thing?
I think we're probably looking at a next Congress type of thing, just because it seems, it's a highly emotional issue, I think, in some ways for people. It's a contested issue in some ways. It shouldn't be, I think. I mean, it's privacy legislation of a type that ought to be easily perceived, right, I think, by people on both sides of the aisle as being an easy issue. But unfortunately, currently in a political climate where nothing is easy or obvious.
It's odd. And I've been at meetings with, politicians, doing the neighborhood town meeting thing. And I brought it up and people kind of gasp, like, oh my God, what are you talking about? This sounds, impolite. And then you explain to them what it is and like, oh, that's awful. We should do something about it. But, there is this initial distance, like, oh, I don't know, let someone else take care of that.
I think that's right. There's a difficulty in talking about the issue because, as a general matter, people get anxious about conversations that touch on sexual behavior.
Right.
It's just something that people don't want to talk about. And to some extent, this is an issue that has been undermined in some ways by the fact that people assume that something like displaying naked pictures of people without their consent, lots of people thought the law. So we're kind of fighting against the impression that many people assume that the law would make this a crime already. And many people don't understand that actually, you know, for reasons of either not having thought about it well enough or other reasons, we don't have the laws on the books that many people just kind of assume that we did.
Now, in California, I know some other states have sex offender registries. And I noticed the model law doesn't require registration as a sex offender because this is usually a misdemeanor, not a felony. But do you think, you know, whether it's even temporary or not, that should be an element as to create a greater deterrent?
It's a tricky issue, partly because at least in my view, the sex offender registry doesn't do what it should be doing. In other words, if the sex offender registry were a very, very careful registry, that is to say, made it absolutely clear that there are certain types of antisocial, pathological behaviors that would make a person eligible to be on the registry and be, mm-hmm. and actually be able to effectively demonstrate that, rather than what we have, which is a sex offender registry that makes very little distinction between things that many people don't consider to be even criminal, much less that wouldn't consider to be unethical, much less criminal,
all the way to
statutory rape, some forms of statutory rape, some forms of public intoxication that resulted in people exposing themselves in the middle.
True.
Of. If we have a sex offender registry that doesn't make clear distinctions between someone who urinated in public and someone who abused a 5-year-old, then it's not doing a very good job of communicating what we'd want it to communicate. And we know that the consequences of being on that registry can be so severe and counterproductive that this is one of the reasons why CCRI has not recommended that this necessarily be part of the way that we think about the crime. That being said, if appropriate to think about the crime as a sex offense, which some states have done and other states have not, because if we want to think about what we should be really concerned about when it comes to sexual misconduct, it's the types of sex that are non-consensual. It's the sort of pathological inability to recognize that other human beings have rights and to simply, because of your own interest in entertainment or money or revenge or whatever it might be, that you're willing to act this way. I mean, it does, I think, set you apart as somebody who's really...
Now, revenge porn or cyber exploitation, hasn't been addressed, and partly in some of the same reasons cyber harassment often isn't addressed is the victims are largely women. And do you believe that that's part of the factor?
I think it has to be part of the factor. If we're looking at the history of criminalization and of offenses in this country, at least, we just have a terrible long history in this country of trivializing the types of things that tend to happen to women more than men, and especially the types of things that men tend to do more to women than any other formulation. So if we're looking at everything ranging from domestic violence to rape to sexual harassment or street harassment, we have a terrible time in this country recognizing that when these types of things, abuses, are serious and they need to be condemned and they need to be deterred. It took us a long time to even acknowledge formally in our law that some of these things were a problem. And even when they're acknowledged in the law, we have a terrible time actually enforcing them because we have law enforcement sometimes that simply doesn't care, or we don't put the resources into looking into these types of crime. And we just tend to think of the things that men do to women as being overwhelmingly sort of excusable. So we have to get rid of that impression. We have to get rid of that idea of going to keep having this problem, whether it's revenge porn or sexual assault or anything else. We're going to continue to have this problem if we don't confront the social attitudes that say that it's acceptable for men to use women sexually without their consent.
And you being in the foreground on these issues, does that make you a lightning rod for those who are, I guess, anti-woman or somewhat misogynistic?
Probably. I think probably any woman with an opinion becomes a kind of lightning rod for that. So I certainly am in good company, but I think there are a lot of different I guess you could say there are a lot of different people. It could be because that people are anti-woman, that they're overtly misogynist, that they take issue with a lot of these things. It could be because they have misguided perceptions about freedom or about what it means to have a right to expression or a right to privacy. But I do think that any woman especially, but any person up issues that do disproportionately affect women, they do become lightning rods. And that is one of the sadder statements on our current society, I think.
And it's interesting, we've had this very disturbing election, and there are times we hear about what is known as the Trump effect, that somehow it seems to have enabled or licensed behavior that maybe a year ago people would have been some more reluctant. Seeing that at all in this arena in terms of, the treatment of women, or conversely, has the exposure of Trump's behavior in terms of his bragging about sexual assault, has that actually had an educational effect?
Right, I think it's had sort of both. It's had this negative and this positive effect. I think on the one hand, one of the most things that's come out of this whole sexual assault conversation that we've all kind of found ourselves in because of Donald Trump's actions has been the difference between people who think that there's something, that this is no more than racy talk, right? That we don't seem to know the difference between racy talk and sexual assault. And that was really alarming, not surprising, but I would say alarming to a lot of people, that that is not or should not be a difficult line to draw. We're not talking about whether or not someone's ever used profanity or whether or not they've ever spoken crudely. But even the descriptions of what Donald Trump was saying on that tape in the bus, for anyone to just call it dirty talk or to say it's a crude conversation is really doing violence to the English language. It's right. Not, that wasn't the problem, right? And so that seemed to be quite alarming. But at the same time, that's exactly the conversation that we're also able to have in a way that grabs everybody's attention, because now we're talking about it, whether we like it or not. And so I think that you see parallels of that everywhere. And the reason why non-consensual pornography exists to begin with is because there are people who no difference between sexual consent and non-consent to sexual activity, and that's incredibly alarming. That it's as though we're pretending that we don't know the difference between consensual behavior and not, but we do all know what the difference is. You can share as many naked pictures as you want if people consent to being shared that way, just like you can have sex with as many people as you want if people consent. But it should not be something that we have to debate or even disagree about the terms to say that's not, when someone is describing grabbing something their consent or sharing a photo without their consent, we should be very clear that this isn't sex talk or sex, sexual behavior. It's something quite different, and it should be a crime.
And in both cases, you do have a certain blame the victim aspect to it. And a couple of years ago, we had a revenge porn victim and advocate, Becca Wells, on our show, and she has on her blog Women Against Revenge Porn segment about her being an involuntary porn star, and I quote this passage from it in every revenge porn complaint I file, and she says that what people don't realize is that as a victim of revenge porn, I am not a victim one time. I am victimized every time someone types my name into the computer. The crime scene is right before everyone's eyes, played out again and again, and ironically, I am as if I am the one who's committed the crime. I am victimized every time someone tells me it's my fault because I consented to the taking of the photos. And and I hear that time and time again. And they report something to the police officer. The police officer, well, why'd you take the photos? And a lot of times, sometimes they didn't. They didn't know they were being taken, or they were taken against their will, and then don't worry, I'll get rid of them. And now they're on the internet.
Right.
And
it's incredible to me the way that Becca has been able to express this so eloquently, in spite of the fact that it takes this daily toll on her, as it does take on most victims, that she puts it so beautifully. And I hope that everybody reads that, because this is, we were talking a little bit about why some people resist really doing anything about this issue and why there might sometimes be reluctant to heavily penalize this issue. I think the other answer is there's obviously a there's a base out there that revenge porn is appealing to. It's not just about private agendas against certain women. It's an industry. Revenge porn sites are very lucrative. There are people out there who take enjoyment from knowing that this woman did not agree to being seen this way, and yet you get to see her this way. And I think that that's what we also have to address, that there are people here who find this entertaining. There are people here who recognize that every time you click on Jennifer Lawrence's hacked photos, that you're doing something wrong, but you feel you can say, well, everybody else is doing it. It's okay. And we're not willing to confront the fact that all of us are participating to some extent in this normalization of voyeurism.
Right.
And that's something that we really have to confront.
Now, you've also taken an interest in the role of violence against women, because that seems to be an element of harassment, and have waded into another controversial area, the Second Amendment. Tell us how you walked into that path.
Well, in some ways, they're very much intertwined. If one is studying, as I have been for over a decade, the dynamics of violence against women and girls, you inevitably have to deal with the fact that so much of that violence comes out in terms of social media and other forms of communication. But also, of course, there's this very dimension of actual physical violence against women. And so much of that, at least in the United States, is intimately connected to the question of firearms. And that one of the stranger things that's happened in the last few decades or so is that you've had a Second Amendment movement that not only refuses to acknowledge how significant the role of firearms happens to be in terms of perpetrating violence against women, but has actually tried to offer this narrative that, in fact, firearms will save from violence. And so it struck me on many occasions that there's something very perverse about this current state of Second Amendment fundamentalism, as I like to call it, that's somewhat similar to First Amendment fundamentalism, which is people trying to tell women that, you know, these things that are actually oppressing you and harassing you and threatening you and maybe actually killing you are actually good for you.
Right. I mean, I think you published some data showing that women are more likely to be harmed by a gun in the house than to be using it for their own protection.
Right. And this has, you know, this was misinterpreted by people who are determined to misinterpret things as being about a statement about women's skill with guns. It has nothing to do with that. It has everything to do with acknowledging the fact that most women are going to face violence from someone that they know. And most of us are not going to have our hands on our guns if we happen to be sexually assaulted or attacked by our husband or our boyfriend.
Right. We're going to take a short come back. We'll be talking more with Marianne Franks after these messages. You're listening to the Cyber Law and Business Report only on Cranberry.fm.
Stay tuned for more of the Cyber Law and Business Report after this brief recess for our sponsors.
Great websites today need expert web design and development and need to be e-commerce ready and mobile friendly. But building a marketable and profitable website can be an uphill climb. Ready to make your new website or replace your existing website? Think Orange as the new way to get in the black. Orange Hill Development works with Fortune 500 companies and offer the same top quality development service at a fraction of what other providers charge. Brands like Absolute, Carlsberg, and Nestlé trust Orange Hill Development. Find out why you should trust your website with Orange Hill. Contact Orange Hill for a consultation today at orangehilldevelopment.com.
Looking for a white label SEO and social platform for your clients? Think
eBrands.
Bring in unlimited SEO audit reports.
eBrands.
Premium Facebook apps and welcome page creators.
eBrands.
Twitter management app, analytics, and mobile site generators.
eBrands.
Let eBrands manage your search and social media campaigns and give you and your clients access to their white label dashboard, which have great reports that will wow your clients and deliver great ROI and results. Try eBrands for 30 days. Go to eBrandsWithAZ.com or call 1-866-625-5717. That's eBrands with a Z for
eBrands.
Literature is taking over Miami streets. Between November 13th and the 20th, downtown Miami will transform into a full-week celebration of the literary arts. More than 500-plus authors are coming to share their new work at the 2016 Miami Book Fair. The Porch is...
Pick out some new favorite podcasts now at Cranberry.fm.
The best gavel-to-gavel legal news and information on the net is right here.
This is the Cyber Law and Business Report. Here is Bennett Kelly.
And we're back, and we're talking to University of Miami Law Professor Marianne Franks, who's also the Vice President and Legislative Director for the Cyber Civil Rights Initiative. Marianne, if people want to get involved in the Cyber Civil Rights Initiative, how should they do so?
Well, the easiest way to get involved is to go to the site, to look up the Cyber Civil Rights Initiative and find out about what we do and to see what you're interested in. If you'd like to help us in terms of providing support for victims, if you'd like to help with legislative efforts, if you'd like to help us as we talk to tech companies and think about ways that they could address this problem.
And the site is actually a very good site. It's very for practitioners or those seeking information on this issue. It has a listing of laws involved, and as well as for victims, is a list of lawyers who handle these type of cases on there. So it's very much a resource. Now you're a professor at the University of Miami. You're taking on some high profile and at times controversial topics. How does that play out in your environment?
Well, I think for the most part, it's something that. It seems like a sad testament to the state of the world, because I guess it could be perceived that these issues are controversial. Certainly it's true that reasonable people can have different ideas about certain of these issues. What seems unreasonable and really quite tragic is that we are apparently living in a time where having opinions and wanting to do work and advocacy on these types of issues generates sometimes incredibly violent responses. And that seems to be just increasing as opposed to decreasing in our society. So it's complicated in the sense that I think, it's always complicated if you're receiving death threats and rape threats as a professor or as anybody. But it also is this extraordinary opportunity in some ways, because I know that it's a way for my students to see what the real stakes of the law actually are, that it sometimes can become easy for us who are studying the law to be distant from it and to talk about statutes and to form and to talk about crimes as though they all happen at one remove from us. And being able to have a voice on these issues allows me to share with my students the kinds of experiences that I've had and continue to have about what it means for the law to actually take these issues seriously.
And how do students respond when they hear that you've had death threats or rape threats? Or
I usually don't tell them about that.
Okay. come to your where you can see your professor killed. I guess that would not be a selling point. But I guess, what do you, when you do talk about it, what do you tell people?
Well, in terms of the threats, I think the main thing I want to say about them is that I want to take note of the fact that this is a very dysfunctional response, right? That if you have disagreements, I mean, this is the extraordinary thing about the privilege of being an academic. We put priority on is that you can disagree about many issues, in fact, vehemently disagree about issues, and you can still be civil to each other. And you certainly right. don't have to resort to threatening someone. That we learn to tolerate opposing viewpoints because that's the nature of our job. And I think it's the nature of lawyers generally to be able to see that, right? That we have to be able to understand that people can have differing viewpoints and there is no excuse for then responding in a violent or aggressive fashion. And so I think wish that more of the world could be like a law school classroom where you actually have to be civil and you actually have to be professional and you can't respond to a viewpoint you don't like or one that makes you uncomfortable by just, screaming at somebody or threatening them with violence.
And which is very true, but it's always disconcerting when you get that threat. I mean, I've received death threats as well, probably not as many as you, but it does make you think. And it's definitely, it's not something you want to have happen. And, I'm sure there's some days you say, this really sucks. And, maybe I should do something else. But, then at the end of the day, you think, no, you can't let them win.
Right. I mean, especially since it seems quite clear that so much of the death threats that are, or other types of threats that are, because they're trying to to, that it is part of a concerted effort to try to get people to stop talking when they're saying things that are making other people uncomfortable. So if we want to talk about First Amendment implications, there are a lot, right? I mean, that threats and these types of attacks are designed to chill speech, and that we really need to take that seriously. And some of us are lucky enough or foolish enough to proceed regardless, but lots of people are vulnerable and are not talking because of the fear of threats, and they're not sharing their experiences because of the fear of threats. And that is a tragic thing for freedom of speech.
Now, in our little insular community of I guess academics and lawyers, there are certain prestige positions or prestige topics, constitutional law or privacy law. And I'm always mindful of a conversation I had with Daniel Citron. We were at a privacy law review. And I was surprised about the number of people who were there and how well attended it was. And then this would have been mid-2000s. And at the time, if you brought up cyber harassment, people would say, well, why are you bringing that up? That's not the issue right now. Let's deal with that later. And it just seems that it doesn't get the attention. People don't want to talk about it. They, go away. You're infringing on free speech, or you're threatening Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. You're just troublesome. Can we talk about this later? Not that to belittle the other topics, and particularly privacy, but it's fond of saying, show me someone who's committed suicide because there was a cookie on their desktop, and then maybe we can talk. But it seems like there's a reluctance to want to address this head on some levels at academia.
I think that's right, and it's a great credit to Daniel Citron, who has, for so long been trying to draw attention to these issues, that I think there's been a real effect because of work like hers and others who have really tried to say these things are not separate from or marginal to these important issues of freedom of speech and privacy. They're actually all connected, and we can't talk about the First Amendment if we're not going to talk about the effects, silencing effects and chilling effects of harassment on women in particular. So I do think that's true, that there's been a kind of avoidance or trivialization, and that people like Danielle have really helped us get to a place where I think people are taking these issues much more seriously.
Now, we only have a few minutes left. Now, in terms of obviously, I've gotten a lot of attention for the work you're doing in this space, and particularly your recent speech at Drake. But is there anything you have coming up that you want to bring to our attention?
Well, there's a lot of work that I'm continuing to do. We're trying to ensure that all the states that don't have non-consensual pornography laws do have them. We're trying to encourage those that have somewhat dubious or not laws will actually try to reconsider and redraft some of theirs. We obviously want to do everything we can to try to get the federal bill passed in Congress and make sure that people continue to have their awareness raised about these issues and others. And I've got an upcoming book on the effects of this kind of radicalization and fundamentalism that people are displaying when it comes to the First and Second Amendment. So those are keeping me pretty busy.
That's so. When might that come out?
Supposed to be finished by the June 2017. So I'm hoping that it's going to come out in 2018.
Great. Now, will you be doing a lobby day or a Hill Blitz day for the federal bill?
At the moment, we're trying to plan those events. We're hoping that there will be an event out west. Actually, we want to be able to talk sort of in the middle of Silicon Valley and have an event to really reach out to the tech community there and get some good conversations going. We've done similar events before. We're hoping to do another one. And then to obviously have some more events also on the Hill to make sure that everybody's aware about the significance and the importance of this legislation.
And there's background on the legislation as well as Marianne on our show notes, which are at cyberlawradio.wordpress.com. And Marianne, I want to thank you again. It's been a pleasure having you back, and I wish you best of luck. Let us know if there's anything we can do to help, both at the federal level and Rhodey. And So you have a friend and a friend here, and we're happy to help anytime. So thanks again for coming. And if people want to find you, what's the best way to do so?
Well, if they want to tweet at me, as many people do, they can. My handle there is MA_Franks. People can also reach me at marianne.franks@gmail.com.
And last but not least, you are a, I'm going to mispronounce it, but you are a self-defense instructor in the Israeli self-defense. What is it called again?
It's called Krav Maga.
And how did you discover that?
Well, it was actually, I was living in Southside Chicago, which was nerve-wracking in some ways. And I was having a conversation with a good friend who was a martial arts expert. And I had said, in kind of despair, I said, you know, I wish that I had ever learned a form of where I felt that I could defend myself, or if I wish there were some sort of martial art that didn't take, 10 years to learn, and that would just teach me how to defend myself in everyday situations. And he said, there's this form called Krav Maga, and that's exactly what it does. And when I moved to Miami, I discovered that there was a studio in my neighborhood, and I thought, well, that's a pretty good sign. And then learned that that's exactly what it is. It's really a matter of trying to survive if you're ever attacked. And so it's for very real life, practical scenarios to keep somebody from groping you to being able to disarm somebody with a weapon.
So critics out there, listen, you do not want to mess with Marianne. So, but it's been a pleasure having you, and best of luck to you. And hopefully we can get the federal bill passed next year.
Let's hope so. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And thank you for listening. This has been Bennett Kelly with the Internet Law Center. Check us out at internetlawcenter.net. And yes, we do handle revenge porn cases. Join us next week for another edition of Cyber Law and Business Report, right here on Cranberry.fm. Have a great week.
The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and their guests, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff and management of Cranberry News Marketing and Cranberry.fm. Rebroadcasts or retransmission of this content without proper consent is prohibited.